Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is David Smildy, who's the Charles A. and Leo M. Favreau Professor of Human Relations at Tulane University and a senior fellow at the Washington Office on Latin America. He has studied Venezuela for 25 years and has written and edited 3 books on the country, and he curates a blog called Venezuelan Politics and Human Rights, and he's testified to the United States Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Smildy.
Thank you for calling, Ian.
And the television pictures you see of Venezuela today, with the general strike taking place by the opposition in a last-ditch move to head off a power grab by President Nicolas Maduro, burning tires, deserted streets, tear gas. You know, the government has its colectivos, these vigilante groups roaming around, and you've got all these young kids, I think about 100 of them have been killed so far, facing up to the riot police and their cannons and tear gas, etc. But it sort of has a feeling that this is a country on the brink. What's your take on it?
Well, it certainly is. You know, the thing is that we've been saying that for a couple of years now. It always seems like it's on the brink, and it just keeps going on. No, sometimes it's a little bit hard to keep people's interest in what's going on in Venezuela, because just one conflict after another, and another never seems to lead to any kind of resolution. But today was somewhat different in the sense that it was a general strike, and it was largely observed by the population. I think the opposition coalition can't complain. Most businesses were closed, but only banks and government offices and a handful of businesses were open today. And the citizenry actually went beyond the general strike, and in many places, on their own accord, shut down neighborhoods and major streets. And so Caracas today was basically shut down. And I think that was true of a lot of the country. Of course, the closer you are to the sort of the urban middle class areas of Venezuela, the more this paro cívico or this general strike was observed. When you get to, you know, the rural areas and the poorer barrios, I think there's probably less observation of this general strike. But in general, it seems to have been a success.
But so far, Maduro has completely ignored the opposition, marginalized them. He's even sent his thugs, the colectivos, into the assembly to beat up all of the Congress members. And he's got a Supreme Court that's essentially a puppet operation, a rubber stamp. And the only person that seems to be standing up to him is the Attorney General, and they're really going after her. So it's hard to see that the opposition have any political gains, and it doesn't seem that Maduro's in any way interested in compromise. And he doesn't seem to be aware of the fact that his citizens are in absolute pain, and that he's a complete incompetent and a disgrace. And there he is on television dancing, and he has his own TV and radio show. You know, I mean, what a joke. So what's going on? Is there somebody else running that country behind the scenes?
Well, you know, I don't think so. That's what people always say, that Maduro is just a figurehead, and that it's really armed forces and other people that are behind him running the country. You know, to a certain extent, it's true in the sense that there are a lot of different powers that are behind him and a lot of vested interests that want to keep things the way they are. But Maduro is actually in a very powerful position. I mean, Hugo Chavez basically spent 14 years concentrating power in the position of the presidency, and Maduro has inherited that. So he has, on his own accord, any number of times marginalized people that, you know, were pressuring for a different direction or for some kind of economic change. So Maduro, I think, actually has more control than people think. I do think he's somebody that's not a capable president. He's not somebody that has a real degree of reflection and the ability to reorient himself and really give a reading of what's going on. I think a lot of the really absurd distortions, the economic distortions we see, I think are largely his doing. I think a lot of the government would have gone along if he had tried to reform, but he fundamentally does not understand economics. So, I mean, currently in the current situation, indeed, the opposition has been for 110 days protesting. There's been 100 deaths. They've paid a high cost, and they're making a real push, and that's because they're facing an existential threat. You know, this constitutional assembly, this constituent assembly, I should say, that Maduro has called is something that would, I think, completely wipe the opposition off the map. It would, change the whole nature of the state. I think it would no longer would be a democracy in the normal way we think of it. No, a federal system of national government, state government, municipal government, and universal direct vote. It would be something more like a Soviet democratic centralism. A sort of corporatist pyramid, starting with communal councils and going all the way up to the president. So I think they're fighting, and of course you wouldn't necessarily expect somebody in Maduro's position to really concede until he actually has to, no? So I'm sure they're aware that the situation is pretty grim and that the opposition is pushing really hard. And, in this type of situation, change happens when it happens. It's hard to really know from the beginning because people are not going to let on because part of their power is making their power seem inevitable.
And again, I'm speaking with David Smiley, who's the Charles A. and Leo M. Favreau Professor of Human Relations at Tulane University and a senior fellow at the Washington Office on Latin America. He has studied Venezuela for 25 years and has written or edited 3 books on the country, and he curates a blog called Venezuelan Politics and Human Rights and has testified before the United States Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Well, I was watching TV last night, David, and I saw a piece on Venezuela where people in droves were crossing the bridges into Colombia, and they've been going across the border for a long time, selling gasoline, etc., on the black market. But these were people that were literally giving up on their own country, and I guarantee you these are not wealthy people. These are the kind of people that the Bolivarian Revolution is supposed to have helped. And many of them had tears in their eyes. They just it was hurting them so much to leave their own country, but they simply could not survive. It seems to have reached that point. So you have a kind of new oligarchy. It seems that you've got the sort of the Chavez oligarchy, you've got the drug smugglers, and you've got the Cubans. I mean, I'm trying to break down this power behind the scenes. You alluded to it. But what is the role of the Cubans? Because we know that Maduro was educated in Cuba, and he doesn't seem like the brightest bulb. And if they're behind the scenes, I believe the former head of Cuban intelligence has a very prominent role there in Caracas. And the SEBIN, the Bolivarian National Intelligence Service, and the Military Intelligence Service seems to be heavily influenced, if not controlled, by the Cubans. And you've got former Minister of Defense in custody, General Raul Baduel, for criticizing the Cubans. So what's going on with the Cubans? Are they really running the show?
I don't think so. There's a long tradition within sort of opposition criticism and commentary about the situation, saying that the decisions are made in Havana, that Venezuela is actually a client state of Cuba. And, I think all of that is exaggerated in the sense that Cuba is much more dependent on Venezuela and Venezuelan oil than vice versa. No, Cuba needs Venezuela more than Venezuela needs Cuba. But, as you mentioned, Maduro was educated in Cuba, and the people that are in Maduro's inner core see Cuba as sort of like their mentor, as like their experienced big brother. And they pay close attention to what they say politically, and they go to them for advice. And I think a lot of the tactics that we've seen in terms of development of intelligence, of controlling the military, of how to police social upheaval, I think there's a lot of Cuban influence there. And so I think Cubans have a really big impact. I mean, right now, there's some interesting moves. Juan Manuel Santos from Colombia was in Cuba this week, and one of the things he wanted to talk about was the possibility of Cuba participating in some sort of negotiations with Venezuela. I think that that's probably quite unlikely because I think Cuba would have no interest in that, and I think Cuba has a great interest in this constituent assembly going forward, and Venezuela becoming another sort of revolutionary pseudo-democracy in the region that could be, a strong ally, an ally with oil. And so I think Cuba has no real motivation for that. I think, you can imagine in certain circumstances things really deteriorate. Cuba could provide a key role by providing safe haven for Maduro and his inner circle. That's something that could defuse the conflict and provide a real service. But as far as actually, fomenting or participating in negotiations, I'm hard to see what Cuba's motivation would be.
But in these circumstances where a country is literally falling apart, in this case it's an oil-rich country, so there's hardly an excuse for how a country with the world's second biggest reserves of oil could be in such disarray and on the brink of bankruptcy, where there are no medicines and the food supplies are intermittent at best and staples are not available and people are angry and they're taken to the streets. And I believe this, that, you know, without accurate polling, there's something like 85% of the people of Venezuela want this Maduro out. They're sick of this. So something's keeping him in power. And then you always assume in these circumstances that the military will step in. And of course, Chavez himself, back in 1992, as a military officer, staged a coup. So Latin America is not unfamiliar with coups. So the expectation that under these dire circumstances, patriotic colonels will show up and save the day, my understanding is that that's not likely to happen in Venezuela. You know, whether it's a good idea or not is beside the point. It's just not likely to happen simply because the military have been basically infiltrated by the Cubans.
Well, I think more than that, the Cubans have advised on how to create a loyal military. And so for 18 years, the government has weeded out people that are not seen as loyal, has built, basically promoted people based on their loyalty. And, you know, in the past 4 years of the Maduro government, Maduro has made it a top priority and has given the military all kinds of goodies, has given them ever more space within the government, given them control over citizen security, given them a television station, a bank. Now they have control over all the imports of food and distribution in the country. And so all of these things are lucrative opportunities for corruption and kickbacks. And so, yeah, I don't, you know, it doesn't seem promising that there would be any kind of, you know, military involvement or military stepping in and say, hey, we're going to have elections. You know, it just doesn't seem, you know, anything can happen, but it seems like, you know, they've had a long time to sort of prune and train this military to be absolutely loyal. And Maduro, you know, for a long time, many of us were watching closely the behavior of the defense minister, Vladimir Padrino Lopez, who some people thought could have reason to separate from the National Guard or separate from the government, and in fact made some critical comments about the National Guard. He's from the normal services, from the Army, who's not involved in policing the protests and not involved in corruption. But Maduro made some changes and has Padrino Lopez as the defense minister, no longer has him as control of sort of as like a joint chief of staff of the armed forces. And so his power is reduced now. And so Maduro has sort of artfully balanced different military people against each other. So at this point, it does not seem likely that the military would have that kind of role.
Well, of course, President Trump has threatened sanctions against Venezuela if they go down the Cuban path and essentially turn themselves into a Soviet-style pseudo-democracy. And we have this outrageously incompetent and dangerous and ignorant president. So I have no faith in him, and I don't imagine the Venezuelan people do. I should think that anything that Trump did would backfire enormously, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, he's not popular at all here. I think, you know, in terms of the sanctions, you know, I think the sanctions, there's a couple different possibilities of sanctions. One is the existing legislation that was sponsored by Marco Rubio that provides for targeted sanctions. That legislation was rolled out in 2015 and used on seven different individuals. And the idea there of those kind of sanctions is to sanction certain individuals, freezing their assets in the United States, blocking their visas, and that would serve as some sort of example for other officials in the government. And that, you know, that sounds like a really clever idea, but when you look at how it works on the ground, it might have that impact, making some officials think twice. But it also creates this cadre of ultra-loyal officials who suddenly see their futures as synonymous with the future of this government. And so the seven people that were sanctioned in 2015 were all promoted. They were all given high-level positions in the security apparatus or in state industries. This year, Tariq El-Aissami, the vice president, was sanctioned as well. And he has since then has been absolutely faithful radical and has been part of this real authoritarian push. No, the supporters of sanctions point precisely to the Attorney General that you mentioned before, Luis Ortega, and say, well, there's an example of how sanctions could work, and you know, it got her to think and separate herself from the regime. But then if you look at it closely, well, all of her actions have been blocked by the Supreme Court, which has a core of six justices that themselves were sanctioned. And that Supreme Court now is trying to replace her with Catherine Harrington, who is somebody who was sanctioned in 2015. And so you can see all these things, these sanctions might have some effects, but they also have opposite and probably unequal effects on the people who themselves are sanctioned, who become key players in the regime. So the Trump administration has also talked about, floated the specter of economic sanctions, of sanctioning the oil industry. Now, that would be an absolute disaster in Venezuela because, you know, this is a country, you know, both Marco Rubio and Luis Almagro of the OAS have said, oh, this would not cause any kind of human cost. But if you look at the numbers, you know, Venezuela, 95% of its foreign earnings come from oil exports, and it imports over 70% of its food. And so, you know, sanctioning the oil industry would probably cause massive starvation in Venezuela and probably cause a refugee crisis, you know, because it would have such an incredible impact. I think it would also, you know, bring countries in the region into solidarity with Venezuela, and I think probably would lead Venezuela to develop much closer ties with Russia. And so I think that would be an absolute disaster of a policy. I hope they're just floating it as a sort of threat and don't plan on actually doing it. But, you know, it's something that is definitely on the table.
Well, David Smalley, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
All right, thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with David Smalley, who's a Charles A. and Leo M. Favreau Professor of Human Relations at Tulane University and a Senior Fellow at the Washington Office on Latin America. He has studied Venezuela for 25 years and has written or edited three books on the country, and he curates a blog called Venezuelan Politics and Human Rights and has testified before the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the possibility that Arizona will have two U.S. Senate races in 2018.